Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a weekly podcast that explores roles and opportunities within the creative industries, with the aim of contributing to increasing diversity across the board, in addition to promoting some awesome women. Episode 11, I'm joined by social engineer, cultural producer, and historian, Rina Atienza. Rina is an adventurer. Play features in everything she does, and she has a kinetic energy that reverberates into any space in which she steps. Having completed a BA in History of Art, and then an MA in Social and Cultural History, she went on to work for advertising agencies for a number of years. In 2013, she decided to leave the advertising world and considered what she wanted to do in her role. She landed on Social Engineer and founded Evil Midget Limited, an enterprise that specializes in creative mischief, social experimentation, and epic adventures that group people together, working towards making the next day better by building a preferable present and future. For a period, she was lead facilitator for the London division of Street Wars, a real-life assassin game where you hunt down your target using water guns. It's open to anyone, free to join, and is played across the city over the course of a month. It's intense. Feeling the itch for something different, she attended a retreat in 2015 to spend time considering where next to place her talents. This resulted in her making a decision to leave London, her home for over 20 years, and move back to the Philippines to focus on writing, in addition to soaking up the sun, warmth, and beaches of Manila. During her time there, she focused on her writing, whilst also beginning to explore other creative opportunities, which resulted in her working for Train Station, an education and training organisation, and whilst there, trained as a life coach. She then went on to become the Senior Communications Coordinator for the Management Division of Climate Change Commission for the Philippines, and speaking at the Argos Summit 2017 on how climate action impacts on women. She returned to London in late 2017 and is currently putting her play skills to good use, consulting on an educational Brexit board game to help prepare the legal industry for the implications and changes that leaving the EU will bring about. She's a motivational speaker, she guest lectures at universities, leads workshops, and is a social activist. Rina, it's wonderful to welcome you to Greater Than 11%.
Good morning.
It's lovely to have you here, and I'm wondering if we can start with you telling me, what is a social engineer?
In terms of a title, obviously we tend to be defined by the job descriptions we have at the time or what we're paid to do. Mm-hmm. And so when I left full-time industry roles in 2013, I did have to figure out what would be still an easy title, but that I could unpackage and be more adaptable to the other roles that I want. An engineer was the best one, because obviously it's someone who designs, builds, fixes, or maintains engines, systems, structures. And I thought, well, I could apply that in a social context, which is obviously relating to people or communities and the systems that people build around those communities. So we call these rituals or cultural practices. So it's really stemming from my background as an art, social, cultural historian, mm-hmm. and understanding that the world we live in terms of communications of what we see, what we hear, or what we experience exists through different evidence. And it's just shifting it from, instead of looking at churches or paintings, I start to look at other social artifacts or social objects that's in the communication space. Mm-hmm. So that's what a social engineer does, is just look at that world yeah. and then figure out the different components. And then depending on who you're working with or for, identify, oh, it's this part that needs fixing, replacing, updating, or maybe it's these parts, or maybe it's the whole thing altogether.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you've done a lot. So maybe if you could give me a bit of a charted kind of history of how you've arrived to now at this point in your career.
I would say it's always been driven by curiosity and trusting people. So when you finish university and, you know, you do the whole job application and meeting interviewers or prospects, it's that initial chemistry. You get hired, and it's really, I guess, a kind of choose your own adventure of, okay, what's presented to you now and what are your options? Is it choose A or B? And that's pretty much how it's been. So although you don't have this linear structure of like a definitive start and end, it was just figuring out, okay, who am I with? What's available now? Okay, I'll take that. And that involved generally following people that you liked or liked you back, following breadcrumbs, I guess, in a way.
If you've got the options, how do you look at weigh up the breadcrumb and go, I'm going to dive in, or maybe I'll just step away from this one?
Natural intuition. For example, at one stage, I had two job offers, and both of them were very interesting and same salary, let's just say. But one had more of a problem that I was interested in fixing because it was to do with mapping, and I'm into cartography. And then the other one was the usual communications job, and you know, it was even appealing because I had another colleague who was going to work with it with me, and I had to choose between the two. And I took a gamble and went for the one that my, I would call like nerd radar, was more interested in, like, oh, but it's maps and I really want to fix this. So I went there. And as most startups, it finished after 6 months. And obviously, even at that decision, my sister, who's more of a traditionalist, would insist that you stay what is more seemingly stable, you know, but there's benefits and it's an established company versus a startup. And sure, in hindsight, that would have been nice. But at the time, you really go with that excitement where you genuinely feel that maybe you could solve this more.
Do you ever get fearful or hesitant, like, oh, I'm taking a leap of faith, this might not work out? Or do you like, I love that adventure, I'm going for the risk?
All the time. You definitely, this is, I think, you know, you definitely feel the nerves. And I guess I was always a bit of a jumper. So, and that is, I guess, the sense of play or the sense of adventure of like, well, I need to figure out where this page turn could be. So I'm going to jump. And there's like a metaphor for that. Like when I was 4 years old playing around with my cousins, we had this challenge of just jumping on the bed and who could jump the furthest. And I decided to be a little bit more bold and say, well, I can, you know, leap further from the bed. So I went on this table dresser where my mother had, but it had wheels, which I didn't quite consider at the time.
Could see how this was going.
So I was revving to jump to the bed. The dresser moved a little bit backwards. So I miscalculated, and so I hit the headboard. But in a way, that pretty much is a story, represents a lot of decisions I've made and that I will jump more.
And obviously the important question is, did you jump the farthest? Did you beat your cousin?
I did, well, of course.
Worth the stitches.
But obviously ended the game because then I had to go to hospital.
Well, ultimate winner. Yeah. Cool. Can you tell me who you typically work for? What's a typical day, if there's a typical day?
Well, a typical day would always start like most people. So you know, you'll have your usual coffee, breakfast, look at emails. I try to wake up earlier so that I make sure that I have meditation before I begin. And the way that I tend to structure my days isn't, again, isn't an exact template. I try to look at a day as it relates to the rest of the week. And a formula that I've discovered, and it's thinking about your time in terms of different categories. So sleep, focus time, play time. Then there's downtime, which is very different to play time. There's inner time, which is, I guess, what meditation is when you're just being still. And then there is physical time, in whatever way you want to interpret that, traditionally exercise. And then, of course, finally, you have what's called connecting time. This is the social bit. So those seven types of time, I look at my schedule and I figure out how I address all those. And I try and make sure that I have a balance of those seven types. Work, currently, for example, I'm working with Movember. And it's campaign season, so there's definitely focus time. Yet, because you're in an open space and you're with people that you enjoy company with, the connecting time is there, and it's a bit playful because fun is one of the values that Movember represents. You know, having fun while doing good.
I'll have to look into that. I'm fascinated by things like that. Because I have a very entrenched morning ritual, which involves meditation and all that. And if I don't do those things, you know, my day will feel off kilter. So, yeah, sure I'll investigate. So thinking about clients, and I want to say typical clients because I know you won't have typical clients, it's just not your nature. But you mentioned working with Movember. Who else do you tend to work with? Because you've got all these skills and being a social engineer is quite broad and all the things you can get involved in. Who would you work with on a regular basis or irregular basis? Or
nowadays, I tend to definitely follow trying to find people who are more self-aware. So I tend to gravitate towards those who have a sense of being comfortable in their own skin and knowing that these are the jobs that I want to take and these are the clients I want to work with, rather than following it on paper that, oh, but it's this brand and it's this company and there's these you know, awards and reputation. And trust is a key issue that I tend to follow now. But for me, it was a strong sense of, I would say, my values, right? So that is something that has been consistent. So although the job descriptions may be kind of, I don't know, not as structured as an approach, it was just following what is legitimately of interest. So I would accept jobs that I really was interested in, or initially at least, rather than, oh, I'll just take this.
Yeah. Okay. So thinking about what you do as well, you tend to work with organizations that sometimes are more rigid in their culture and their day-to-day, and you bring in this playfulness and this mix-it-up and try new things. How does that work? Like, how do you bring that, and what's the reaction normally when you're trying to get maybe a large organization that is very fixed in the way that they behave?
Sometimes, as much as you want to adapt, you can only have control of your own actions. So you can be patient or you can be amenable as much as you like. But if the other person, again, has their own, say, program or pathways that's just not going to jive in a way, then I make a decision and like, all right, is this worth pursuing or not? So it's not a precise science in a way, and that's why it is a relationship work of just kind of experimenting and making bids, so offers and saying, okay, what about this? Oh, okay, not that one. What about this? And then what I've learned is to no longer be so personal as I was in, like, you know, straight after university, that when those bids are accepted or not, or rejected, it's just great. It's just really throwing, so in a way, just throwing what you've got in your toolkit to say, okay, not that one. What about this? Sure, not that one. And then celebrating when it does fit or make sense, then, like, you know, you do the little hurrah.
Yeah, hearing you talk then, I was just thinking, I mean, you're so observant, then analytical, analyzing the problem, problem solving, and offering up a solution. And that's happening rapid fire when you're within that kind of situation. That's, yeah, brain power.
Oh, thanks. I would like to credit, though. I think it is, and that's why I'm such an advocate of serious play and games beyond just, oh, that's just for kids, or, you know, that's just for keyword. If it's, let's just gamify that.
Yeah.
And I think it's the training to that I've received by doing those games in being able to identify components, different parts, different phases and stages, and then handling resource. So in a way, I do, like, life is this big game in the sense that there are players. So, you know, we think of it as theater, immersive theater, but there are players and agents, and we have these mission cards or goals, right? Like, I have to do this. And then you're given a set of resources. So some are infinite and you can keep renewing them, and some are limited and, you know, or you can only use it once or twice. So that's how I've now, like, firmly seeing the way things work. It's just that no one is really stupid. And we'll feel that way. We want to accuse, oh, that person is, you know, this adjective or that you know, derogatory adjective. But really, it's a case that we operate with what we know. So with what we've programmed, what we've, so learned behavior or what is nurtured. And also what we've seen, like monkey see, monkey do. And like, well, this is how it was in my last job and it worked then. So I think everyone's really making decisions based on what has worked before or what they're comfortable with, and they will just keep testing that. Of course, I would prefer, you know, a path where I can comfortably say, oh, I've stayed in this company X number of years, mm-hmm. and things have progressed really beautifully in a nice chart, mm-hmm. where my salary's increased, my promotion, and all that. But that's just not how it's played. Mm-hmm. And so I found myself, well, I could be upset about that and think, oh, am I a failure? Am I not getting right? Or am I just built differently? Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, fine, let's just play with that and embrace it. And, like, you know, surrender to that flow, and understanding that it's just a different pattern of behavior.
I don't know how to respond to that. I mean, it's fantastic. And also you're talking and I'm like playing like games in my own mind, thinking about different paths and things, you know, and decisions you make and flipping them over. Just talking about it, like enacts that, which is amazing.
Well, as a creative, you'll always understand that when, you know, you get a brief, right? Mm. And again, you have a fixed piece of paper with certain words and certain structure, and this is our problem. But creatives or whoever reads it thinks, actually, are you sure that's what you want? You know, it's not a paint by numbers job, right? Yeah. It's always more rewarding when it deviates and when things get shaped properly.
And in my creative practice, in my artwork, actually, it's the process of concept and making that is where I most grow, where I have the most fun, where I'm really enjoying it. The end product is just a byproduct, really.
Yeah, it's
all that bit in between. That's where the real kind of thinking and change and thinking about, you know, what it's going to be representing and how the audience will react and then making that connection with the audience. You know, like I said, the end bit is like, okay, there it is. Always slightly disappointed. Not that it hasn't worked, but it's the bit in the middle that I really, really love, where I feel my own growth.
Yeah.
So speaking of other creative processes, could we talk about your writing? And what shape that takes and what it is and where it kind of finds its place in the world?
My writing tends to have evolved from essay writing in terms from doing a history degree. Mm-hmm. What I found fascinating is just that it's become more of like a living history way of processing the world that I see or that I experience. Mm-hmm. So it will be mostly thematic, mm-hmm. and based on real stories that happen. So mm-hmm. stranger than fiction tales of, mm-hmm. You know, you just find yourself in a situation seemingly mundane, waiting for a bus, mm-hmm. and nothing to tell about that. But then a stranger will then enter your space, ask you a seemingly mundane question like, "Where are you from?" Mm-hmm. But even then, that's strange because, you know, it's odd being stopped at the bus stop by a stranger, and it's not, "Hello, what a lovely day, are you waiting for a bus?" Mm-hmm. It's immediately personal to, "Where are you from?" So, you know, someone clocking your visual appearance. And then that evolves into another mm-hmm. dialogue, and it becomes a story, and it stays with me because it's strange. So I end up thinking, okay, how do I share this strange story with someone? Mm-hmm. So it starts with a conversation. Someone says, "Oh, that's really funny. You should do stand-up comedy." So you're thinking, oh, am I going to do stand-up comedy now? Sure. Or maybe I'll write it into a longer essay about if I want to be more thoughtful about it. And it's just, you know, this issue about what I call immigrant bingo that's happening. It's like, where are you from? No, where are you really from? Mm. And then how, I think I'll, because of the way my mind works as well, I'll connect that to other more bigger themes in terms of, is it connected to Brexit? Is it connected to London's diversity, culture, etc.?
Uh-huh. And so how does your writing then inform the other side, the social engineering, the cultural production, which it obviously folds into, actually even asking you that question, I can, you know, kind of guess what the answer will be. But how do these two things, you know, coexist?
I guess having references. So the subjects that really I engaged with at school, art, English, history, mm-hmm. and that relates to strongly the visual in certain parts, the modal visual, kinesthetic, and auditory stuff. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm going to look at the world and notice patterns and rituals and be curious about why people are behaving or doing certain things, that obviously is the same when it comes to a job, right? Because it's just, people may not be creating a cathedral or being commissioned to do a triptych. Mm. But same thing, they have someone who wants to pay for a thing in order to communicate something about them in the world. So, and it's just shifting from understanding the means to communicate has exploded in a way that it's not just painting or architecture. It is now Facebook posts mm-hmm. and blogs and tweets and mm-hmm. all sorts of formats that people are becoming writers, publishers, creators. Mm-hmm. And so I see it that way. It's just like a smaller form of those art history rituals that I've studied mm-hmm. and understanding that, yeah. So what we now do is create a photograph or a poster that will be visible in X parts of the city. Mm-hmm. And then you see like the workshop in terms of, oh, you know, here's like the lead artist and here's the project manager. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, that's how the great artists worked. They had workshops, they had apprentices, and they had patrons as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And then, you know, and then I guess it's just like the micro or like whatever is in my personal definitely affects the professional and vice versa. It's not separate. Yeah. And it's only perhaps now that we're beginning to understand that. Mm. Because before it was, you know, we say, oh, this is my work life and this is my home life. Yeah. But the reality is that it's the same.
Yeah. I mean, I really struggled for years, actually, with my art practice and then my agency work. I graded them on different levels. You know, this was more for the great good, and this was something that I did and I enjoyed, but didn't feel like it was the right thing. And I had to really work on that. And actually, I got to that point where I was like, actually, the two inform each other. Yeah. And actually, they're better for each other to have Absolutely. Them work together. But yeah, I mean, I think that's there for a lot of creative people as well, this separation. And then getting to a point where you're like, actually, it makes more sense that they're friends.
Yeah, they're the same. Yeah. When I gave a talk at Silicon Beach in Bournemouth a few years back, I think someone was outraged that I kind of just said something which a lot of people in the room were like, yes, it's just, I agree with that one, that creativity flourishes outside of the agency life. Mm. And I don't know what happened where at some point, you know, people were told labels like this is what you can be and this is what you cannot be. Mm. And we try to fit in those molds. Mm. And then we also figure out, okay, this is quite nice. And I also want more, or I want to experiment with this. Mm. And I'm glad that we're progressing towards that field, yeah. You know, gig economy, free range, freelance. And that is more richer than I think a sense of being limited. Mm. So there's a difference. If you're happy with being an expert or refining one thing, mm-hmm. that is great, so long as it's your choice. Mm. What is unhealthy is when you feel pressured, oh, I have to stay here, or I've been told this is all I can do. Mm. That's the difference. It's just like allowing people the choice to be plural or singular as much as you like and flip, between or, yeah. Or like another thing as well, it's just like a friend of mine said, when asked about things like, oh, what are you? You know, people ask that, we was like, oh, I don't know how many in-betweens I am.
That's great. That's what I often feel. So what skills do you need to be an effective social engineer? If someone was considering going down that path.
I took a test, one of those trying to identify what your skills are. And there's different types. But the one that I resonated with, because it was really scarily accurate, and again, I'd wish I'd known these five words sooner, and it would have given me more focus, but again, like, nature finds its way anyway, is that it's called Clifton Strengths or Strengths Finder, and one of those surveys, so on a different modus, like the whole, are you ENFP and all that, mm-hmm. but mine were strongly the five words were my top skills was connectedness, mm-hmm. learner, input, activator, and then command. So those five words pretty much consistently define the choices that I have made. So in a different lens, it seemed eclectic, but they consistently show all of those five words, mm-hmm. that I always see how one thing is connected to a variety of other things, that I've always just been a keen learner. Like, I love information, so I always find, like, oh, that's really exciting, or thank you for telling me that. It's just a, teacher's pet, I don't know, school, like, loving school and appreciating education and how it's never a done business. I can never read enough. I can never learn enough from people. And then the input is that because I enjoy learning, it's also then complemented by the appreciation for wanting to share it, for wanting to say, oh my God, did you know? Or I saw this cool thing as well. So the enthusiasm is then wanting to share that or interact with others and bounce off ideas. And then the activator part is then deciding, okay, what are we going to do about it? Right? Like the activator part of, like, what can we start? What can we do? Let's just play with it. Let's just see where this leads. And then the command bit is being decisive. Let's just run with this. Like I said, let's just jump, because you can overthink it or you can overplan it. You're not going to know until you just make a move. And again, like, games allow you that. Like, you know, there's a certain amount of time that you can consider, but that game's going to end up like 12 hours. Otherwise, you make, you need to make decisions. So as a social engineer, for me, that works. It might be different for another person. But what is helpful is studying the behavioral patterns. Communications is complex, but if we need to simplify it, there is a formula that I was taught through my other agency, like Train Station. It's called VBBR. So everybody wants results. I want this, I want that, and their outcomes. And then, so those are, that's the R bit at the bottom. But results are determined by behavior. Right. We want people to lose weight. That's a result. And therefore, the behavior is eat, you know, less of this. But behavior is influenced by belief systems, which is the key to driver to change. Well, we can change behavior to a point, but it's not going to be as long term or as effective as changing belief systems, limiting belief systems. And then beliefs are influenced by values. So what we intrinsically hold close to us of what we want. So love, pleasure, all of these different themes. So a social engineer would have to look at that structure, like VBBR, like values that become belief systems, that become behavior, that lead to results. So I guess it's like having that. And when I was studying my master's, three key things, which I'm just grateful for and worth every penny, was learning about globalization as a theme, civil society, and then nationalism. And those three big themes are pretty much the drivers of behavior in the world as we see it, see it today. And it's not something that, obviously, I can say I'm a master of, because I only did like about 2 years of it. But being able to grasp at, oh, people behave a certain way because of these more universal themes. And for me, I wouldn't have been able to come to the conclusion that, oh, I'm going to be a social engineer if I didn't study and understand those three things. Because they pretty much, like, and then part of me also, the joke is like, what? I spent this much money and studied 2 years and I can summarize like the world and key things. It's like, ah, okay. There's a joke in there somewhere. But that's, you know, that's fascinating. It's just, and to know that I can keep on reading more and more.
So thinking about your creativity and your playfulness, how do you nurture that? I know you talked about the mind platter and thinking about those things, but what do you actively do? Where do you go, et cetera, to nurture that playfulness and creativity?
Part of it is, I think it's lucky being in London and exposed to different stimuli, right? You'll get a newsletter, you'll see ads. Ads are great, and being able to see a poster for an event. So responding to the visual stimuli, but mostly it's not even a case of, because otherwise then you'll go crazy. It's just more, who do you go with? And I am pleased with the people that I've met, not just through working in the agency world, but the friends that you've and you know, that you collect, I guess, that you end up having around you. And it's true what they say, that, you know, people around you is a reflection of who you are as well. And so making sure that there's a variety. And a lot of the activities or things that I can say I love now weren't originally mine. It was like something that I saw from a friend, and I thought, who invited me, right? Who said, like, oh, do you want to do this? And I would say, oh, it's not really my thing. And then you end up trying it, and then it becomes your thing. and that's great. And then you then gift that forward.
Yeah.
And if someone else responds to you and say, oh, you know, like, so at the moment, like, I'm singing in a choir, and that's great. I so sometimes, you know, if people ask, oh, what are you doing tonight? And like, oh, I'm, you know, rehearsing, I'm singing in a choir. And then you start talking about it. So I guess it's more of I feel like I'm a bumblebee or like honeybee, like the cross-pollinating. Like, you know what appeals, what is your kind of radar, and then allowing the random, what do you call the random factor, which isn't so random. After a given time, it becomes serendipitous or even like more like synchronicity. So open, I guess being open and saying one of the great lessons that is implemented in training sessions, is implemented in comedy, is called the yes and. It's always building of accepting. And yes and doesn't mean just saying yes all the time. Yes and can also be no. You know, there's that whole art to saying no to things. But generally it's, like, growing, evolving, or just like accumulating, like, and then eventually when you accumulate, you have to discard certain stuff to make space for new things.
And you also grow, don't you? So you're like, that served a time, that was perfect, but actually I've kind of either jumped or leapt or moved on from that. Okay, so what projects have you got? What are you working on in the next few weeks, months?
This is actually... So previously, so as part of Evil Schemes, and which is, it's more like an Acme factory. It's not like an official company, but it was something that I wanted to create as an umbrella for all the different activities that I've done that's on my CV. I'm generally always scheming. I'm like, oh, maybe I could do this. And I have like a list. This year, I've decided to, you know what, I'm going to try the no plan plan and go with the flow and see what is more active, and then in a way it's more focused. So working as part of Newsbacker Associates on this Brexit project is definitely something that I'm going to focus in, because it's a most present need or urgency. It's definitely a wicked problem in that no one knows if it's where it's going, but that in itself is a wicked problem, right? Like, how do we navigate through or around? There's also other opportunities that I might just raid the archive cabinet of things that I parked before. I do want to figure out how I can transition what I'm doing with the Brexit project to the issue of climate change, because that in itself is another, wicked problem that people think, like, oh, is it really a thing? And yes, it is. But in the way, that's the ultimate game of resource management, of like, what are we doing with this planet? And so trying to move on there. And again, it's I parked that after leaving the Climate Change Commission in the Philippines and seeing it's quite an eye-opener of like what government job is like. So again, shifting of like, can I still do some of that work, but from a different camp? So I don't know what that camp is. We'll find out next year. But it's partly like focusing on this engine that we're building, or this toolkit for Brexit, and then see how that can also work well for a different problem. I don't have a list right now. I just have a bunch of toys that I've not played with in a while. And maybe over Christmas I'll have a think of what can be played with next year and who with. So, like, and that's nice. Like, I think also I've learned that it's not always about constantly being busy or hustling. And it's more like, aligning and recognizing the rhythms of life. And it doesn't always have to be that I have a thing and that's okay. Sometimes it's just, so now in a way, I just have a couple of things as opposed to maybe 10 things that I was juggling in different seasons.
Yeah.
And that's good. That's good too.
Cool. We're sadly at the end of our interview. It's been so lovely talking
to
you. It's been fantastic. I always end up the interview asking all guests if there's a career or job in the creative industries you know little about and you'd like to know more. So potentially I could get someone in that role on the podcast. And also a woman in the creative industries that you'd love to hear on Greater Than 11%.
I'm still really keen to find out about coders, right? So the other side of a more material engineer. So if, yeah, I'm definitely curious and either because of like working with them. But like I love how, for example, escape rooms are built. So it's a combination of physical sets, but then there's the I don't know, like electronic or digital elements of it, and that's something that, because I'm not familiar with coding and building of those electrical, electronic, digital artifacts. Yeah,
like, me too. I'm it's really something keen. So
exactly.
To,
so so mine are more.
And it's such a different way of thinking. That's what I'm really attracted to. It's so creative, but it's in a really different way that I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, definitely. That's going to happen.
Yeah.
And a woman in the creative
A woman.
Industry.
Yeah. I would definitely want to recommend Caroline Sparks. She is very creative in the way that she lives her life, even though her job titles have never been specifically as an art director, designer, illustrator. But her brain is definitely something worth picking, and I've benefited from having a professional and personal friendship with her.
Great. Sounds fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very
podcast.
Much also for
it's
the
been
invite.
So fantastic speaking to you. I've got lots of things to think about.
Great.
Cool. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please write a review on Apple Podcasts, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%. And also stay subscribed to keep up to date on the weekly releases. This podcast is made possible by the support of Hub, an insight-led content agency based in London. A huge thank you to the producers, Pat Murray and James Haberson, and to Mary Continenza for designing the beautiful artwork.